Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the latest news from the city of West Texas? Last night's massive explosion at a commercial fertilizer manufacturer set off a cascade of destruction that affected virtually every resident in the community of about 2,700 people. Courtney Collins is on the scene in West for KERA News Now and joins us with an update. Courtney, what is the latest on the injuries and the death count?
Hey, Chris. Well, so far, we're given the same information that we've pretty much had all morning. They're not really comfortable releasing a hard number for the death count yet. They're still giving a range. They say it's confirmed that there are fatalities, and we're looking at between 5 and 15 people dead at this point. As far as injuries go, they say we're up to about 160-plus people were injured as a result of the explosion.
So that reluctance to give complete figures would suggest they're still looking for missing people?
Yes, that is a big part of what's going on. They said the search and rescue process is continuing. They know that there are people still missing. They specifically mentioned at a 10 a.m. press conference that we're still missing some volunteer firefighters for certain. Search and rescue is ongoing. They're describing it as very slow and very methodical. Part of the issue is that they have to secure a lot of the buildings before they can go inside and search. There is so much damage and devastation from the explosion, but it's not safe to just go in every home or every structure and see if there's someone inside. So there's a lot of work that they have to do before they can even get inside and check whether or not a house or a structure is clear. So they're working to secure things. They've got a lot of people involved in search and rescue at this point. We're talking about fire departments, area emergency management crews. There's a federal search and rescue group that's actually called the Texas Task Force that's involved, and they also have some utility groups involved, like Oncor is going to be a part of it because they need to make sure that there's no live power lines that workers could run into and cause more problems. They said their priority number one is still to save lives, but they also have to be very careful that they don't further injure anybody during the search and rescue process.
How are all these efforts being coordinated when you have a very small municipality like West, located in McClellan County, dealing with people coming from agencies in regional areas?
Well, so far they've had different spokespeople. Up until 10 a.m. today, they had someone from the Waco Police Department that was kind of coordinating all the information. His name is Sergeant W. Patrick Slotin. He kind of gave up his post for DPS. They're going to be taking over kind of as a point people as far as dissemination of information goes. But it's really just very coordinated. I think when you have a small city and a smaller county, you kind of have to work with a lot of different groups. So they're very, very organized, and they seem to have all their information flowing between the sources. But it's a lot of different groups involved locally, on a state level, and also federally at this point.
What's the weather out there like this morning, Courtney?
There is substantial rain earlier. As I drove this morning south, it was a driving downpour and thunderstorms, and that lasted until about 10 a.m. There was even substantial rain during the 10 a.m. press conference. That's cleared up a bit. It's pretty light out right now. It is not raining, but the temperature has gone down quite a bit. It's much cooler than it was even earlier this morning. So they say as far as search and rescue goes, that's something they really want to take to heart, and they want this process to go forward as quickly as it can because they don't want people stuck out there in the cold and the wet that need to be pulled free.
Okay, so we were hearing last night about damage for several square blocks around the area. How much damage is there in the light of day, and are people still being asked to stay out of the city entirely, including people who are residents of West?
Yes, that is absolutely true. I asked that question at the press conference, and 10 people are still being kept out of their neighborhood. I spoke to a couple people who were hanging around in the local hotels who had been temporarily displaced, and they had not even been allowed to go back to their home to retrieve prescription medication they both needed. So they're being very serious about keeping evacuated residents out until they can secure everything. The damage is pretty widespread. Today, they're saying that between 50 and 75 homes were significantly damaged. We also know about the apartment complex that is a part of this, and that's a 50-unit apartment complex, so it's not a very small group. And we know about West Rest Haven, the retirement facility that had about 130 residents. So we're talking about a lot of people who don't have a place to call home right now.
I know that you've talked to people who were close to the blast when it happened. What sort of descriptions are they giving you?
Well, it's been really moving to talk to the folks involved because I think it was nearly impossible for them to process what was going on at the time. I mean, I think most of us can't really imagine sitting in our house and then feeling an explosion. But what I keep hearing over and over again is war zone is what it looks like. Earthquake is what it felt like. So everyone was just kind of bowled over. They felt the blast and then everything in their house just kind of started pinging around them. I mean, we're talking about things shattering and becoming shrapnel, doors, windows blowing in. I mean, they just didn't even know what to think. I spoke to one woman who had been sitting on the couch and got up to walk into another room. The explosion happened and her front door blew onto the couch where she had just vacated.
And of course, this is a part of the country where people are familiar with disasters like tornadoes, and yet this one feels like something entirely different.
Absolutely. I don't think anybody can get their head around what happened. I saw so many people today that were still in their pajamas from last night or their work clothes if they had worked a late shift who had clearly just been told, get out of your house and go. They had, one woman didn't even have her purse. She just had her pajamas, some sneakers, and she had been clutching her phone at the time, and that's what she took with her.
Courtney, is there a coordinated response for people who are effectively refugees from this disaster, at least for the time being? Are they all gathered in one place? What's happened?
Yes. Well, what's going on right now is the West Community Center has kind of become a little informal command post. It's fielding calls, so if people are looking for loved ones or they're trying to find help or services or they're trying to volunteer to help themselves.
And we have that number. Excuse me for interrupting you. We have that number on our website so people can find
that. Right. They can call that number or they can drop by if need be. I think City Hall is actually staffing it, so people from the area will probably see some familiar faces from the City Hall staff at the West Community Center. And then it's really been astounding to me just visiting some of the local businesses in the area. I mean, the Best Western off of 35 had opened their doors, were letting people eat breakfast that hadn't stayed there the night before. They had, basic medical supplies out on tables of people were nursing scrapes and bruises. Then we went to the briefing here at 10 a.m. That's near the Stockyard Cafe, which is the small cafe attached to a cattle auction facility. They are feeding everyone free today. They have businesses dropping off lunch. They're feeding the media, law enforcement, anybody, and just asking if you have a dollar to stick it in the bowl. So it's really been very coordinated as far as the community wrapping their arms around each other. I don't think anybody is going to be in trouble for long. It sounds like every local business and everybody that has a house still standing is more than willing to take someone in or help someone out.
All right, Courtney, I know that you are working on a story that will run this afternoon during All Things Considered. Can you give us a preview of what we'll hear then?
Sure. I'm really going to talk a lot about how the nursing home West Rest Haven was affected by this explosion. Like we said before, more than 100 residents, about 130 people were involved. And what's interesting about the story that I'm working on for today is the staff saw the fire that started this whole thing and began to get the residents up and out of bed so that they could evacuate. They were in the process of starting an evacuation on their own when everything happened and broke loose. And we're going to hear from an employee who is digging people out of the rubble, as well as someone who was in the nursing home asleep at the time and their family members kind of playing the waiting game as they came to town today.
That's Courtney Collins reporting for KERA News from West Texas. Thank you so much, Courtney.
Thanks, Chris.
For more information throughout the day, you can go to keranews.org. We'll have continuing coverage there and live blog updates throughout the day. You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can we learn from catastrophic situations like last night's explosion in the city of West Texas about the nature of resiliency in any community? And what existing knowledge can we apply right now to ease the suffering of those directly affected? By coincidence, the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture is hosting a conference this week to explore what makes a resilient city. And among the expert panelists invited is political scientist Thomas Homer Dixon. He's chair of Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Toronto and has devoted much of his career to studying threats to global security and ways that society can best manage the risks. His multiple books include the 2006 title The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. Tad, welcome back to Think.
Delighted to be with you.
So we're still trying to get a handle, of course, on the breaking details of the situation in West last night. And I know that you've just arrived in town yourself. But is there a predictable sequence of human responses in times of chaos?
People always pull together as a community, and we can see that in this situation, as was just explained in the newscast. And in your interview, people reach out to each other, and especially when there's a strong sense of community identity already existing in a place. So human beings create resilient communities very naturally. If you think of resilience in a certain way as being able to bounce back from some kind of shock or catastrophe. Part of what we're talking about at our meeting over the next day is how you can try to build in more resilience in advance, how you can make communities even more resilient and think about what the possibilities of shock are or catastrophe and make sure you can respond even better to them.
We, of course, always want well-coordinated efforts. However, you have advocated that there are many times when people ought to be encouraged to sort of think for themselves and figure out what the best thing is that they can be doing in the moment. Can you talk a little bit about those two aspects of response to an emergency when oneself might, in fact, be in danger?
Resilience involves, in significant part, being able to take care of oneself. So this relates to the issue of connectivity, how connected we are together and whether those connections are going to help us or harm us. Some kinds of connections can harm us because if there's a shock somewhere else in a system, an economic system, a technological system or something, an electrical grid goes down or a disease crops up in place like Asia, the connectivity, the travel between Asia and here, for example, communicates that disease very rapidly to where we happen to be. Economic shocks can spread around the planet right now. A problem in an electrical grid a long way away from us can cause our power to go down. So that kind of connectivity can actually undermine resilience and make us more vulnerable. But there are other kinds of connectivity, like we're seeing in the community of West right now, that increase resilience, especially social ties of various kinds, the strength of what social scientists call social capital. The fact that you know somebody down the road who happens to have a generator and you know they're a generous person and you know and there's a house with, say, an ill person who has some equipment that requires power right away. And so you can make a connection to go get that generator and make sure that the person who needs the power has the power. And those kinds of connections that are built up of trust and a sense of reciprocal responsibility to each other, those are very important for a resilient community.
Are those more easily built in a small town than in a large city?
That's a very interesting question. Now, I've lived a lot of my life in a large city, but for the last 10 years moved to a smaller community in southwestern Ontario. I'm actually no longer at the University of Toronto, I should say.
Thank you for the correction.
University of Waterloo. And I've noticed that small communities generally have a stronger sense of community identity and more of this social capital. But they also have fewer resources to throw at a problem when a problem strikes. So there's a trade-off there. To get back to one other point you mentioned, I think that resilience does put a premium on being able to take care of oneself, whether it's as an individual, being able to fix things, for example. You know that old show, MacGyver. My wife calls me MacGyver sometimes because I love to just be able to fix things.
Chewing gum and a paperclip.
Yeah, I carry a knife around on my belt and stuff like that. But also I think it's about communities being a little bit more autonomous and being able to take care of themselves. Everything from, you know, being able to provide their own food and energy, maybe not all of it, but at least enough of it so that if something happens and those connections to the rest of the world are severed or hindered in some way and those critical supplies aren't coming in, then the community can still survive reasonably well on its own.
My guest is political scientist Thomas Homer Dixon with the University of Waterloo. His books include The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. He's in town to speak at tomorrow's Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture conference entitled What Makes a Resilient City? If you'd like to be part of this conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Thomas Homer Dixon from the University of Waterloo. His books include The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. He's in town to speak at tomorrow's Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture Conference entitled What Makes a Resilient City? You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. When you talk about resiliency being built in part on people's ability to sort of get by on their own, I think in the United States we have this culture of taking care of ourselves, pulling ourselves up by our own bootstraps, but it tends to be economic. In other words, the ability to sort of buy for oneself whatever one needs, as opposed to really contributing to a spirit where people are particularly invested in, say, growing their own food or fixing their own appliances, that sort of thing.
I think that's true. One of the things I admire enormously about the United States, and I studied here for many years, is that that sense of individual responsibility and enormous sense of entrepreneurship. It's something that I think Canadians can learn a lot from, that those cultural aspects of the United States. But it's more than just, as you say, it's more than just economic entrepreneurship and starting one's own business. It's resilience is really about being able, if necessary, to take care of yourself in a variety of different circumstances. And the critical thing here is that you don't know exactly what those circumstances are going to be. So you need to have a range of skills available, basic skills. I think one of the things that happens in our economies is they become more specialized and people have deeper knowledge about very narrow areas to do their particular work is that we actually become more and more dependent upon other people to provide our critical services, goods and services. So we become, in some respects, less independent and less autonomous. We can take care of ourselves less well when we need to. And that's overall, that's not a good thing for society because in a situation where you have a crisis or a shock of some kind, and we see them increasingly frequently in many ways, you want individuals to be able to take care of themselves because sometimes the government can't be there to do it.
When these things happen, whether they are accidental, as appears to be the case in West, of course, we're just at the beginning of that investigation, or they are deliberately caused, like the situation at the Boston Marathon, we all look around and say, we should have seen this coming. And I wonder if sort of planning for the next one, if there's a limit to which that effort is really fruitful.
The distinction between the two events is kind of interesting, and this is just an outsider's quick reflection, so it all has to be put in that context. But the West event, as an outsider, my understanding has always been the fertilizer plants can be pretty dangerous. So it's not entirely clear why you have a whole bunch of residences close to the fertilizer plant, and including a retirement home with people who are mobility challenged at the best of times.
And a middle school.
Right. I just don't really understand that. There's some real issues about, I think, zoning there that would need to be considered. One has to also wonder whether the first responders who were volunteer firefighters had a really comprehensive understanding of what they were dealing with, including the chemicals in the plant, and whether pouring a lot of water on the plant was a really good thing to do at that time. Now, they may have not. I don't have that information. But certainly that's the kind of thing that we would consider in building a resilient community. You would think about, in this particular case, you have a dangerous facility. You want to loosen the coupling a little bit, which means, frankly, just moving vulnerable institutions and vulnerable people further away so that they aren't as much at risk. You want to make sure that the community and especially the critical first responders know exactly what they're dealing with under a variety of different scenarios. So resilience involves in the exercise of imagination, mm-hmm. in part, thinking through different possibilities, both good and bad, about what might happen in the future so that you can't plan for everything, but you can anticipate at least broad ranges of possibilities.
How does the way we make meaning out of particular events contribute to our ability to successfully cope with them and move on? And I'm thinking about the distinction between, again, something that appears to be an accidental event in West and something that is quite clearly terrorism in Boston. Does the fear level, is it different when we know that someone was deliberately trying to hurt us? And does that affect the way we process what happened?
I don't think there's any question about that. I think that was, in a sense, the most traumatizing thing about 9/11, not just for Americans, but for everybody around the world. How could that be done? How could somebody hate so much to want to hurt such large numbers of people that way? And in this particular case in Boston, to bomb a community of bystanders, including children, it just seems beyond comprehension. Now, we don't know anything about the perpetrators at this point, but certainly that's what terrorists exploit. And I've done some research on this, the exploitation of fear. That's why it's called terrorism. Frankly, the incidence of terrorism has been declining quite significantly over the last few decades in terms of the number of people affected around the world. And certainly in the United States, it's actually been very quiet. But that fear propagates, and especially with current social media and communication technologies and 24/7 news, talk radio and things like that, that fear is propagated through networks of communication very rapidly and probably exaggerated in some ways. And that doesn't make for a resilient community.
I've been really interested just over the past few years, the way that social media has become a source of information for people. Sometimes that information can be really important, and sometimes it can be absolutely incorrect.
That's right. And I think that the authorities in Boston and the people doing the investigation in the FBI are being very careful about when they're going to release these photographs, because they realize that there can be a pile-on effect. If they make a mistake and they release a photograph of somebody who is innocent but was doing something that in the videos might have looked a bit suspicious.
As in the Atlanta bombings at the Olympics, there was someone incorrectly identified.
That's
initially.
Right. But now, so different from Atlanta, now we have social media that can mean that you can have millions of people engaged almost immediately in searching for this person and then finding their house and perhaps harming them really viciously. So part of building a resilient community is trying to figure out how to use this distributed intelligence in a really constructive way without creating kind of mob psychology at the same time. So the good thing is that when they do release the photographs, they have millions of people thinking about who this might be, recognizing facial characteristics, like a collective mind that's going to be much smarter in the end and much more capable of identifying these people than the folks within the FBI themselves. So that's a good thing, but it's also messy and it can actually hurt a lot of people too in the process.
We should talk a little bit, Tad, about this term resilience, because clearly by its nature, it means the ability to respond accordingly and recover from traumatic events. Sometimes it seems in the modern world what we really want is to be completely safe and be guaranteed that no risks exist. And I don't know if you think that's just naive.
It is naive. In fact, in my talk tomorrow, I'll be distinguishing between two kinds of resilience. There's the conservative notion of resilience, which is the one that's becoming common in most conversations. I call it engineering resilience. That's the idea that you bounce back to where you were before, the status quo ante. And that's an appropriate notion of resilience in a situation like we experience right now in West or even in Boston. You have an immediate trauma and you want to get back to where you were before with an electrical grid or the air traffic control system. But it's not always satisfactory in itself. It's very conservative. It's very, very risk averse. There's another notion of resilience, which I call ecological resilience, which says that what you need to do in the time of shock is actually change fundamentally. It involves a restructuring of systems, learning why things went wrong, and maybe some deep change in some way. So that form of resilience is highly innovative and more evolutionary. You end up in a different place from where you were before. You're not bouncing back to where you were before. And frankly, when you look at something like the recent economic crisis, I think most people would agree we don't want to bounce back to where we were before, because where we were before had a whole bunch of causal factors that helped create the economic crisis in the first place, particular regulatory regimes, practices by banks, for instance. So we don't want to go back there. The question is, can we use the crisis in a way to encourage the creation of new institutions, new behaviors, new practices that will allow us to be better off in the future, in a new environment that we're facing for the future?
What do we know about why some crises seem to bring out the best in people and bring people together and you have, you know, self-sacrifice, whereas others really cause situations that devolve into significant conflict?
It's almost always related in part to whether there's an identifiable enemy, an outsider group of some kind that tends to encourage or an outsider threat that's identifiable. It's an outside threat. It tends to encourage the cohesion of identity. People pull together and respond, and it diminishes within group differences. So you may not have thought your neighbor was very much like you before, but in the face of a threat to both of you, you start to think of that neighbor as really very much like you. Hmm. And so it tends to homogenize groups and they pull together. The kind of crisis that doesn't produce that effect is one that is generated by actions of the individuals in the group themselves. Now, a classic example would be something like climate change, where mm-hmm. we're all contributing to it and we're all very busy in a game of pointing fingers at each other saying, well, it's not me, it's you, and you need to start first to do something about it, not me. And that actually divides the group and undermines our ability to respond.
I don't think anybody would ever be pleased that we have a common enemy, but it's interesting that there is, at least to a small degree, an upside to that.
There is, and I think to a certain extent how you define a problem is critically important. So there are often ways of defining a problem that may even be caused by one's own actions in a way that sort of externalizes it. And so you can say, okay, we need to pull together to address this problem. So, for instance, with climate change, one way of redefining the climate change problem is to think about, for instance, our children and the kind of world they're going to live within. And most people have children or are associated with children or like children or have nieces and nephews. And so that gives us a common element where we can pull together and think of ourselves as a common identity in defending something that we all value very much. And that reduces the divisions between us. So that's a role for leadership. Fundamentally, how we define our problems, how we, in the jargon, how we frame them. We can frame them in ways that draw us together, and we can frame them in ways that pull us apart.
When you say leadership, Tad, do you mean sort of official government leaders are the people in a position to help redefine it, or does that sort of attitude change actually have to sort of bubble up from within communities?
The two kinds of resilience I talked about, the bounce back form of resilience, engineering resilience, that's really a top-down notion of resilience. You know, lots of plans and officials and experts. The ecological resilience is much more bottom-up, distributed problem-solving, the kind of thing I was talking about when you engage people in social media. You get lots of heads and lots of people involved in trying to address problems. And that, if we look around the world at the most innovative systems, the systems that are most highly adaptive to constantly changing circumstances, ranging from healthy ecological systems to modern market economies, well-functioning market economies, they all are highly distributed in their problem solving. They have lots of agents or lots of people or entities working in an ecology, species or organisms, working on solving problems that are being confronted. It's messy. There's lots of experimentation. Lots of experiments don't work. In fact, most experiments don't work. It's not easy to plan, but ultimately the adaptation is much faster because you're experimenting across a much broader range of possibilities. So truly resilient societies are going to engage their citizens in a conversation about how we're going to deal with future eventualities and allow for lots of room at the community level to experiment on different practices and institutions and ways of living in response to those new realities.
What can we do in order to prepare for catastrophic events that are followed by additional traumas, additional crises? Because it's not always a single event and then you sort of pick up from there.
That's right. In fact, the engineering resilience notion, the bounce back notion, is usually focused on single events, a system failure, a critical infrastructure failure. But something like the economic crisis was started with a very severe shock, and then it's dragged on and on around the world. I mean, it's just, you know, Europe's in crisis, and lots of people in the United States are still feeling the effects. Unemployment is still very high. Now, I should say that resilience is not a panacea. It's not an answer to everything. It's about how we do better in a world that's affected by lots of surprises and shocks and crises. But it doesn't mean that you're always going to do well. We're in a world now which is vastly more complex and under vastly greater stress than previous worlds in some respects. And so the incidence of surprise and shock in some respects seems to be increasing. That we're not necessarily going to be able to do well through all of this. What it does mean, though, is that we have to increase our rate of adaptation. We have to be more imaginative, more creative. Our communities have to be more capable of responding to new circumstances all the time, because the world's just not going to stay in one place.
So how do we build our capacity as a society to respond and adapt quickly and to be willing to take risks to try things that may or may not contribute to the solution?
Well, some of the things I've mentioned so far, you want to make sure that when the first crisis or shock happens, that things don't fall apart. Mm-hmm. So that's part of that's about decoupling the system a little bit, loosening your connectivity, increasing your reliance, your self-reliance, your capability of taking care of yourself as a community or even as individuals, as an urban area, for example. So that's all sort of the first order response when it comes to resilience. But then there are a number of things you need to be able to do over the longer term. And that's where some of the distributed, diversified problem solving comes in, getting lots of people involved in solving problems together.
My guest is Thomas Homer Dixon of the University of Waterloo. His books include The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. He's in town to speak at tomorrow's Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture conference entitled What Makes a Resilient City? We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Thomas Homer Dixon, who's in town to speak at tomorrow's Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture conference entitled What Makes a Resilient City? If you want to be part of the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You were speaking before the break, Ted, about building capacity for resilience, and please continue.
Sure. So you can do a lot of the sort of decoupling and increasing self-reliance that I was talking about before. But over the longer term, you need to increase the rate of experimentation and you need to distribute problem solving in the system as much as possible. So I use the example of Katrina and New Orleans frequently because clearly the community could have been much better prepared for what happened there. It was well known that New Orleans was enormously vulnerable to storm surges. And I remember reading articles in advance, including one major one in Scientific American a couple of years prior, that laid out the scenarios very clearly. My understanding is, though, that city officials did not engage the broad New Orleans community in a conversation about what would be done under circumstances of large portions of the city being flooded, and especially those communities that could be identified as most vulnerable. What you want to do is encourage folks to think through the scenarios, think through what they're going to do on a block-by-block basis, start developing some plans, experimenting with different kinds of response measures. And then there's even a more radical aspect to this, which is, Katrina revealed some pretty remarkable disparities in New Orleans. Well, they're well known already, but for the whole world revealed how serious it was. And given that the probability that something like that happened was actually reasonably high, you can imagine that some community groups, as part of this process of engagement with thinking about what they're going to do in the event of the city being flooded, would start thinking about what they're going to demand in the event of the city being flooded be changed in the city to make sure that they have greater voice or greater economic opportunity or less vulnerability in the future. Now, that's actually the kind of deep change and adaptation over time that the more radical notion of resilience, this ecological notion of resilience, requires. That you evolve to a new place. You don't bounce back. New Orleans doesn't bounce back to where it was before. It ends up being a more adapted and a better place as a result of the crisis, rather than just going back to where it was.
So we can take ourselves through these thought exercises rooted in current information that we have, and yet there's the human tendency to believe things are impossible until they've happened for the first time. Right now, it seems so clear to everyone that something like Katrina could take place, and we ask why no one woke up to the fact. I would imagine that in the years preceding that, those who tried to bring the warning out were told, sure, but we've got imminent problems that are happening right now, and they deserve our attention, and they deserve resources. What do we do about that tension that it seems will always exist in society?
Well, that's an extremely good question. And it was a focus of much of my conversation in my last book, The Upside of Down. Certainly, it seems sometimes human beings just don't respond until a crisis happens, and they don't even think about the possibility until a crisis happens. But this whole approach to planning and innovation and adaptation, the resilience approach that I'm suggesting, really requires that we be more proactive, that for perhaps the first time in modern human history, we start thinking about, especially within our societies, which tend to have very short time horizons, especially driven by a political clock that's 3-4 years into the future, we need to start thinking about possibilities that stretch further into the future, decades into the future. And that needs to be part of our common conversation as a community. Now, it may turn out, as you suggest, it may turn out to be socially impossible, or maybe human beings just aren't psychologically wired to do that. But then we're going to be in a really bad place because our world is increasingly throwing at us these challenges and problems that really, in some respects, shouldn't be surprising, because we have enough information to start thinking about what the possibilities might be, and the disruptions can be enormously severe. Certainly, climate change is one that we have to start thinking about now. If we wait until the crisis hits, it's almost certainly going to be too late to fix. So the time to start thinking about what we're going to do in response to some of the changes we can see coming down the road is now.
And of course, one of the other problems with climate change is that many people would argue we are already feeling the effects of it, certainly in this part of the world, but in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, and there are places in Southeast Asia. But it's always hard to say that this one event is tied to this large moving thing. What do we do to adjust our thinking, not only at the policy level, but at the level of everyday people who vote in the individuals who will make some of these big choices on our behalf?
Again, a really good question. The issue of uncertainty is at the core here, and we live in an increasingly uncertain world. There's nothing we can actually really do about that. If folks come forward, officials and experts, and say, we know what's going on, we have the answers, we can predict where we're going, we can say they're full of nonsense now. People have to accept that there is kind of irreducible uncertainty about all of these things, about where our economy is going, how urban areas like Dallas are going to develop, what the climate is going to do 20, 30, 50 years from now. But that doesn't mean we can't be thinking about how we would respond under a range of possibilities. I don't think we should use uncertainty as an excuse to simply do nothing. And frequently, unfortunately, it is used as an excuse. Well, we don't really know, so let's just wait and see what happens. But unfortunately, that means that we're largely unprepared when whatever happens, happens. And we could have been better prepared, just as in New Orleans, they could have been much better prepared. For even without necessarily a huge financial investment, the communities could have been better prepared to respond to that crisis.
What is the need for resilient thinking, resilient action, resilient planning? Suggest about the way we educate children and young adults these days and what we might change in the current system.
Well, much of this is grounded in a body of work called complexity science or complexity theory, which is an area where I've done work for a couple of decades. So it's a way of thinking about how things happen in the world that gets you more comfortable with things like uncertainty, with multiple causes for any particular event, instead of assuming that there's only one cause that for any particular event, whether it's this incident in West or the Boston bombings or what have you, that you need to be prepared to entertain the possibility that there are many causes, some of which can be adjusted or affected or fixed in some ways and some of which can't. Another key thing about in terms of our education of young people is and of people in society in general is understanding that complex systems can flip from one state to another very dramatically and often with little warning. We call these non-linearities. It's a fancy word for a flip or a threshold effect. Well, while we're seeing a lot of flips and threshold effects in the world today, whether it's a flip of the global economy from a stable to essentially an inflationary state to a largely deflationary global economy now, which seems to be facing chronic crisis. We see things, sudden dramatic events like Hurricane Sandy. There are lots of surprises. And we shouldn't be in a world that's increasingly complex and under increasing stress, we shouldn't be surprised by surprise. All of this can be built into our educational system. It's about how we understand causation. It's about how we understand change. And I think that for the most part, our basic education of children and frankly, all the way up through our universities doesn't really get people familiar with some of these relatively simple ideas about multiple causation, about nonlinear effects. And there's a lot we can do in that regard. It would certainly improve our democratic conversation about things like resilience. Because in a world that's highly turbulent, where that's going to be marked by surprises and shocks in the future, once you start to understand that, then the obvious policy response is a resilience policy response.
Would you put most of the responsibility for those shifts in education on the science teachers or the social studies and history teachers?
Wonderful question. I think it's really both. Mm-hmm. I think in part, for instance, you can look at societies that have done well or communities that have done well in difficult times in the past and go through in your history curriculum or your social studies curriculum, go through the differences between those that did well and those that didn't do well. That would be really instructive, I think, kind of natural experiments in a way that the children could or your young people could explore and understand. And some of it, of course, is about science. Some of the most important ideas about complex systems have kind of come out of physics and math. Some of them are actually very easy to demonstrate with some relatively simple tools that I think should be in basically every classroom across our nations. And they're jaw-droppingly powerful illustrations. And once you see these illustrations, you think, wow, the world actually does operate differently from the kind of linear two-variable causation, cause and effect causation that I assumed before.
I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but can you give us an example of one of these?
Well, one I love to use is a, and some of your listeners may know of it, it's a double-hinged pendulum. it's a pendulum that doesn't have one hinge, but it has two. So and ideally you have two of these on the same pivot point. So you have two long bars hanging from a pivot, and each of the long bars has another pivot in the middle. It's hard to explain without a picture. But the really interesting thing is they behave chaotically. Hmm. You drop the pendulum, and if you drop the two simultaneously and try to make sure they behave absolutely identical. It's impossible to get them to behave identically because it turns out that the smallest difference in the initial conditions for one of those pendulums can make it behave dramatically differently from the other pendulum. And it's the kind of thing that when you show students, and I've shown many students this, they understand the principle of nonlinearity and of sensitivity to initial conditions in a really intuitive sense from then on. And it means that they look at the world in a very different way from then on.
Let's go to the phones here. We have Shannon on the line in Arlington. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, good afternoon. I have two small questions.
Just give us one because we're getting close to
one. Okay. Are there cases that actually the neighborhood is divided rather than be united? And if it is, what divides the nation and our people, local people around that situation?
Are you talking about people who've sort of experienced the same trauma, Shannon?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm not entirely clear on the question, but it comes back to the issue we discussed before, whether communities respond as one or divide up in response to a challenge of some kind. And some of that depends on the nature of the community, and some of it depends on the nature of the challenge. If the challenge is perceived as an external challenge, it's more likely that it'll bring people together. But also, some of it depends on the nature of the community, and whether they see themselves as a collectivity. I think, frankly, one of the problems in New Orleans is that there were some very profound and deep divisions in the community, and that undermined the ability of the city as a whole to respond effectively, or even to begin the conversation in advance about how they would respond in the event of a catastrophe like Katrina.
So you're talking about the social divisions that existed in New
Absolutely.
Orleans, so that it wasn't just one city, it was really a city and a sub-city.
That's right. There's socioeconomic and racial divisions that were profound and that came to the surface in ways that just were astonishingly brutal in the aftermath of the crisis. And honestly, you know, there are many variables, and as I've just indicated, always many variables or causal factors that go into any particular social outcome. But one thing that is absolutely essential if a community is going to do well in response to a trauma of some kind is a sense of common identity, a sense of shared we-ness that we're together in this facing this challenge. Without that, it's very difficult to respond positively.
So if you were going to compare the outcome in a place like New Orleans and a place like New York post 9/11, did New York handle things better because of a common identity?
My sense is that's true, and we could go into a deep sort of social analysis of why, and in particular the leadership at the time.
Leadership and a common enemy.
That's right. It was pretty clear at the time that the attack was by foreign elements,
mm-hmm.
and there was actually a pretty clear understanding of who was probably behind it. Quite quickly because of the modus operandi involved, the multiple attacks and the high skill level involved. So that was classic opportunity to pull together. Now, the interesting thing, though, and I don't know how much time we've got. But
we're almost out of time.
Well, the United States could have responded in a whole variety of ways to that challenge. And one thing that could have been done is it could have been a starting point for developing energy independence for the United States. If it had been framed the right way. And the United States might be much better off now than it is if the response has been structured in that way.
Thomas Homer Dixon is in town for the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture Conference, What Makes a Resilient City? Ted, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I am Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.